Having then gifts differing according to the grace that is given unto us, whether prophecy, let us prophesy according to the proportion of faith, or ministry, let us wait on our ministering, or he that teacheth on teaching, or he that exhorteth on exhortation. He that giveth, let him do it with simplicity. He that ruleth, with diligence. He that showeth mercy, with cheerfulness. Let love be without dissimulation. Abhor that which is evil, cleave to that which is good. Be kindly affectioned one toward another with brotherly love, in honor, preferring one another. Not slothful in business, fervent in spirit, serving the Lord, rejoicing in hope, patient in tribulation, continuing instant in prayer, distributing to the necessity of saints, given to hospitality. Bless them which persecute you, bless and curse not. Rejoice with them that do rejoice, and weep with them that weep. Be of the same mind one toward another. Mind not high things, but condescend to men of low estate. These verses were read from chapter 12, verses 6 and part of 16. No doubt one of the most abused subjects in the entire religious world today is the matter of money, money collecting, giving, and so on. Merchandise has been made of people under the aegis of evangelism and various other religious pursuits. Well, there's no question of it. It's a dishonorable thing. People are tired of it. Who can blame them? Even so, one wonders at times if some of the reaction is not a cover-up for the materialistic attitude of our society. Married people frequently tell me, we'd like to have a bigger family, but you know, we just can't afford it. Things are so expensive today, and it's so difficult to get by, and so expensive to raise children. My reaction is this: nonsense, unmitigated nonsense. My mother and father raised a family of 11 in the post-depression years when people were really poor. I remember a milk war in 1939 when one of the local stores would give you the milk if you'd pay 2 cents deposit on the bottle, and nobody had the 2 cents. Well, I didn't live in the actual depression itself, but I was born in 1934, and I grew up in the post-depression years and know what it was to see families doing without. Now, the sad and poignant fact of the matter is that people are too selfish today. They are too materialistic. They want too much for themselves in terms of things and time. Well, I've found that this is an emotional subject with many people. They get impatient with me when I talk about it. I must say, however, that that has no tendency to intimidate me. I think it's at the point where the shoe rubs that the attention needs to be given. It's true. You know it. We are a materialistic people. I look around in the world today and I think along these lines. In this country, we're all fat and luxurious, even now when times are getting a little harder and we're having to do without a little bit of what we've grown accustomed to in recent years. We have incredible wealth in our community. We live in air-conditioned homes. Most of us have several cars. We have one or two color television sets in the house. We've got so many clothes in the closet, we get confused as to what we want to wear when we go out. We're very picky with what we eat, and we throw away enough to feed armies. At the same time, there are children in the world today. We see them on the television all the time, not fantasies, but realities that are literally standing naked and destitute and starving to death in the dusty roads in the back alleys of life. Something has to be wrong with the thinking and values of people somewhere when this is the case. I know about the offenses and abuses of charitable organizations and how disgusted we can become with them at times, but I wonder if this is a justification for our indifference to the needs of the world around us. Recently, I was talking to a minister friend of mine about children in Cambodia, Pakistan, Southern Africa. He mentioned that World Vision is a group, and I'm not necessarily promoting World Vision now, just pulling this out of the hat, that really seemed to be doing something. And I said, well, you know, the problem I have with that is I wonder if more than 10 cents of every dollar that goes to those people ever gets to the children. Well, what of it, he said rather impatiently. What if they only get 10 cents? It's a lot more than they have now. You don't know what happens to that dollar, and neither do I, but we can make the effort. That is just an excuse not to do anything. When I fell to thinking about that, and in my case at least, there was a lot of truth to it. We see the images of starving children around the world, and relief agencies just now are collecting much money from the Christian community as well as others, as people's consciences have been pricked, and that's good. And we ought to look closer to home, too. There are people everywhere in want of necessities. It's not given to us to ferret out and put right all the inequities that exist in charitable organizations. It's ours to give attention to this aspect of our Christian character, distributing to the necessity of saints. My materialistic attitude and selfishness with my material things is not honoring. And the graft of charitable organizations, whether real or imagined, is not an acceptable excuse. No, it is not. Now, close on the heels of that is this other admonition contained in this verse, given to hospitality. Along with the materialism of our age has come a tremendous self-centeredness and exclusiveness. We have so many things. We do not want to be bothered, or we will not have time to play with them all. We've become so engrossed in our material pursuits, our pleasure, and so on, that we've shut others out. We're bothered by other people. We're put out when they come to see us and intrude into our private lives. We go our way with our heads down and our mind full of selfish thoughts and do not want to be inconvenienced by others. If they come calling, we have to think, oh well, we need to be charitable. We've got to be hospitable. It's required of us. So we greet them with polite, canned, acted out, frozen little smiles, nods, and mm-hmms, oh yeses, oh my's, uh-huh, I sees. And all the while we're thinking, how long are they going to stay? When are they going to get the hint and leave? Hospitality as a group or an individual attribute has largely disappeared from the Christian community in the Western world. I'm not talking about the good time party attitude. I mean friendship and hospitality. It's a sad, sad commentary on the priorities of God's people. The commandment given to hospitality goes begging as we spend our time, passions, and emotions on ourselves. But this is a serious neglect of our ministry and one that has large consequences. People need to be loved. They need to be wanted. They need to be befriended. They need for our lives to be open to them. And it's our Christian duty and responsibility. Well, we should not be brought under the power of the attribute of hospitality. We shouldn't lose control of our lives. We should not lack the ability to be candid and say, well, we can't do it this time, or today it just ensued, or we're busy tonight, can you come another time? We're not talking about falling victim to the attribute of Christian character. We're talking about possessing that attribute. There is time in our lives if we take and or make time to be hospitable, to receive others, to show interest, to invite them in, and to show kindness. Now, true hospitality does not center on the attractive and popular people who are the most likable by nature and who make us feel the best when they're around. Jesus said, go out and invite the unwanted, the poor, and those who have no ability to reciprocate. We need to reach out and take in the neglected, the unwanted, and the friendless of this world. The pressure's always on us to get a little click going, to spend all of our time touching the same bases and mixing with the same people. But if we do that, we will have no time or interest in strangers, the unwanted, the neglected, and the downtrodden. This is a malfunction. The responsibility is to see that you put your hospitality where it can do the most good. Focus on that. Put your endeavors there. Now, no doubt, the great barriers to the blessed, fulfilled, wholesome, and vital life are smallness, pettiness, bitterness, and agony of soul. If I were to pick out a characteristic which most clearly explains why there's such narrowness, dryness, and lack of vitality in many Christian lives, it would be the sins of pettiness, smallness, bitterness, and resentment. As St. James said, we kill, and we desire to have, and we war, and we lust, and we have conflicts because we want and we cannot obtain. People want to be praised. They want to be liked. They want to be looked up to. They want to be successful. But someone is always in their way. So they're always angry and bitter. Somebody is doing this or that to them. This is the old way of thinking, originally by Cain, the firstborn from the creation. It's not new, and it has nothing to do with the pressures of society, as we're often told. It's a native thing to the fallen mind. There were two children in the whole world, and they were heirs to the entire unspoiled creation. Yes, the fall had taken place, but the flood had not come and devastated the antediluvian world as yet. There was all this beautiful world, and two sons, probably twins, but we won't get sidetracked on that, shared this great inheritance, but one was in the other's way. One was envious of the other. One stood in the way of the plans and the ambitions and the schemes of the other. Cain killed his brother because he was jealous, envious, angry, and bitter. In this you can see how native these emotions are to the fallen character right from the very beginning. The Christian is called upon to have an entirely different attitude. Bless those that persecute you. Bless them and do not curse them. Well, you say, I don't go around cursing and swearing at people. I'm a Christian. Well, I think we need to understand what a curse is. In a biblical perspective, we're not identifying foul language when we talk about cursing. We're talking about putting a hex on somebody, wishing them evil, hoping that bad happens to them and that they do not succeed, and using our mental, emotional, and psychological powers to try to oppress and suppress them. We're talking about bitter and angry thoughts of envy and resentment. This is what it means to curse someone from God's point of view. The person who will be holy and acceptable to God is not to do that. And now listen to this. He is not to do that towards those who truly persecute him. You know, there's a great paranoia in our societies and our churches today. And most of the time, when we think that somebody is persecuting us, they're not. We hatch up imaginations. We build hypothetical cases. We try the person and we condemn him in the little court of our own minds. And then at some point in the future, when we find out we were entirely wrong, we just kind of laugh weakly and say, well, nobody's perfect. No wonder St. Paul said the weapons of our warfare are not carnal, but mighty through God to pulling down of strongholds, casting down of imaginations, and every high thing that exalts itself against the knowledge of God, and bringing into captivity every thought into the obedience of Christ. That's 2 Corinthians chapter 10, verses 4 and 5. Nothing works against God more effectively than the imagination. From it arise bitternesses and cursings. Now, we're to bless those that persecute us. Why is that? Are they not standing in the way of our ambitions? Are they not really denying us our right to succeed in life and to have praise and a good reputation and to achieve and acquire the things we want? Well, to the old way of thinking, the old world, the old nature, that's true. But the person with the renewed mind has a different set of values and different goals that he wants to achieve. He wants the praise of God and the riches of eternity. He realizes that no other individual in this world can stand in his way and deprive him of the riches of the kingdom of heaven or anything from the biblical point of view that is really worthwhile. In fact, the very spirit of the ministry is that the Son of Man came not to be ministered to, but to minister, not to be served, but to serve, and to give his life a ransom for many. Now, St. John has said, greater love has no man than this, that a man should lay down his life for a friend. The inferior things that we encounter in life and the mixed up souls who bring them our way provide the occasion, the opportunities, and the arenas where Christian victories can be won and achievements realized. It is here that we, like our Lord and Master, can give our lives for those who are tormenting us because we love them and because we have the Spirit of Christ. These are not defeating experiences, but the battles where victories are won. God allows these things to come into our experience because we need the challenge in order to win the victory and to receive the reward. When someone persecutes you, there's an opportunity to express Christian character and behavior and earn a Christian reward. Rejoice with them that do rejoice, and weep with them that do weep. Many times Christian people think that they're being ministerial when someone comes their way who is really in a low frame of mind, and they chide him. Oh, you shouldn't feel like that. What difference does it really make? The sun will come up tomorrow. Everything will be all right later on. Cheer up. Get a smile on your face. But the Bible calls upon us to enter into that person's suffering. Weep with him if that's what he needs you to do. Enter into his sorrow. Share with him. A number of years ago, I conducted a memorial service for some close friends. A man who had died and his wife had been very, very close. Now, after the service, we were all sitting around her house and visiting. Her children and her relatives were all there with this poor woman who was trying desperately to remember things about her husband. The family was all saying, oh, Mom, don't talk about that now. It's all right. It'll be all right. Let's talk about Sister's new dress. Now, I sat down with her, and I listened to her, and I let her talk, and I even drew her out and let her weep. And her son called me in the kitchen. He said, you know, we're trying to get Mom not to think about this stuff. I said, I know you are. But in that, you are wrong. She wants to remember. She wants to hurt. She wants to weep. She wants somebody to listen to her. This is important to her. She wants to get into these things. Of course they're painful. but they're necessary and they're vital and they're valuable. She needs somebody to weep with her. We must analyze that other person's need, deny ourselves, and get in there with them. They don't need some psychological little platitude. They need a friend. The notion that we are better if we can laugh it off and never fall on our face and weep is part of the foolishness of the fallen mind. The wisest of all natural men, according to God in the Bible, put it in perspective for us when he said in Ecclesiastes 7, verses 3 and 4, sorrow is better than laughter, for by sadness of the countenance the heart is made better. The heart of the wise is in the house of mourning, but the heart of fools is in the house of mirth. Yet, while inferior by biblical comparison, the same thing is true when people are rejoicing. Don't throw cold water on their joy by saying, well, you know, it's a sinful world and we're supposed to be sober. Of course the Christian's supposed to be sober, but when somebody has found occasion to rejoice, rejoice with him. Serve him, in other words. Deny your own tendencies and self in order to meet that other person's needs. Do not use his situation as an occasion to take the stand, to show the audience how much you know. Encourage him in his joy and rejoice with him. Be of the same mind one toward another. Mind not high things, but condescend to men of low estate. Now, there's a strong tendency among Christian people to feel very important about themselves and to make the Christian pursuit a matter of seeking out and identifying with important causes and important people while neglecting the downtrodden, the lowly, the unimportant, and the unattractive. In fact, the latter is where the ministry truly is and where Jesus, when he was in this world, was most apt to be found. St. Peter had stern words for those who are high and mighty and who can't stoop to the lowly brother in 1 Peter and 2 Peter chapter 1 and verses 6 through 9. And besides this, giving all diligence, add to your faith virtue, and to virtue knowledge, and to knowledge temperance, and to temperance patience, and to patience godliness, and to godliness brotherly kindness, and to brotherly kindness charity. For if these things be in you and abound, they make you that you shall neither be barren nor unfruitful in the knowledge of our Lord Jesus Christ. But he that lacketh these things is blind and cannot see afar off and hath forgotten that he was purged from his old sins.